Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, October 26, 2016, only 13 days till the election, and my email inbox is going to celebrate. Today is Hillary Clinton's 69th birthday, and Bold Pack and other Democratic outlets have emailed me 144 times trying to get me to sign her birthday card. I declined. The Republicans have a great opening, and this is not an October surprise, but it kind of qualifies. The new rates for Obamacare insurance for 2017 are being released nationwide, and they are huge. And this creates another argument for Republicans to talk about failed Obamacare, that it was doomed from the start, that it doesn't control costs, doesn't live up to its name, affordable. And I've heard both Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh on their respective radio programs making real hay out of this, playing old sound bites from Obama in 2008. You can keep your doctor, you can keep your insurance. Yeah. And predicting that families would save $2,500 a year. Well, not only has that not happened, but the rate increases are really quite significant. I think in Arizona, it is over 100%. Now, the national average is below 25%. Here in California, the average across the exchange is just under 14%. But we've seen that level of increase annually since Obamacare was implemented in 2014. And I've been using Obamacare, and I have shared with you the deep flaws that I have encountered, particularly when I used the platinum coverage in the first year from the for-profit carrier, Anthem Blue Cross. I'm now using Kaiser, which is an HMO, and the rates are lower, the increases, it's going to be $130, about 9% for me in the coming year. But if you get hit with a 25% increase, and you're self-employed like me, you can hope that the subsidies for low-income people will help to ease that, to soften the blow a little bit. But for people who don't qualify for the subsidies, but must buy their insurance through the exchanges, again, self-employed individuals like me, it's a real hardship. Donald Trump momentarily was on message yesterday in Florida. He said, "Obamacare is just blowing up. My first day in office, I'm going to ask Congress to put a bill on my desk getting rid of this disastrous law." Now, it's an easy, fat target for them to aim at. It is unpopular, particularly with Republican voters. But they never say what they'll replace it with. And what would happen to a self-employed person like me if Obamacare goes away? But Trump, with his limited attention span and his myopic focus, he didn't stay on message very long. He took reporters to his Doral Golf Resort in Florida to try to get them to give some free publicity to one of his properties. Today, he's scheduled to attend the opening of his new hotel in Washington, built by undocumented immigrant labor. Media doesn't point that out very often. In one of the debates, Hillary pointed out that Trump Tower in New York used non-citizen, undocumented labor. But it's very clear that's happened in Washington, yet that is not widely reported in the corporate media. And at the Doral yesterday, Trump passed the microphone to some of his employees and said, "Hey, tell people how it's going here working for me, for Trump." And before he handed off the mic, he said, "You better say good or I'll say you're fired." And he said that a lot of his employees are having trouble with Obamacare, but then the manager of the Doral clarified that 95% of the people who work there are on the company plan. They are not even covered by Obamacare, so they can't be experiencing any discomfort from it. And there's an interesting piece in the local San Francisco paper, the Chronicle today, where they take a look at the large insurance, health insurance marketplace. The vast majority of Americans get their coverage through their employer. There are 157 million people who have employer-paid or partially paid health care plans. And those costs have remained relatively stable over the last 5 years as Obamacare was drafted, passed, and implemented. And what they show is that family premiums in California increased an average of about 5.5% per year. But the deductibles of individual employees are lower in California than the national average. That means that employers haven't shifted to the cheaper plans with higher deductibles that shift the cost to the insured, to the employee. And I remember the good old days when I worked in corporate media and had good employer-paid health care coverage. It actually was through my union, SAG-AFTRA. But the employer paid for it. And it was very good coverage. Now, there's another interesting perspective to consider here. We have heard these insurance companies crying that they've lost money on Obamacare. And I understand that it may be true, because Obamacare, with the no limit on pre-existing conditions and a couple of other factors, it produces a pool of people who are desperate for health insurance, and many of those people are sick, or they have conditions that require them to use their health insurance. And until we broaden the pool to include healthy people who pay premiums, not through the nose, but just average premiums, but don't use health care very much, and that's my situation. I don't go to the doctor very often. I'm very fortunate. But the only way to get there is single payer. And Public Citizen, I've linked to their report, shows that the top five health insurance companies, despite the fact that some of them are backing out of Obamacare marketplaces, are still massively profitable. In 2015, Aetna's profits were $2.4 billion, Anthem Blue Cross, $2.5 billion, Cigna, $2 billion, Humana, $1.2 billion, United Health, $5.8 billion. They have made more than $65 billion in profits since the Affordable Care Act was made into law. And so, it's all real logical. And we have this likely next president named Hillary Clinton, who certainly understands our health care system and has been burned by it. She tried to reform it when Bill was president in the 90s. And she got clobbered. And so she lowered her expectations and poo-pooed Bernie Sanders' call for single payer and universal coverage and said, well, you know, Bernie Sanders wants to destroy Obamacare. That was a pure lie. But now she's kind of hemmed in. She does support a vague notion of a public option. And over at The Guardian, an op-ed writer, Celine Gounder, wrote a piece, Obamacare price hikes show that now is the time to be bold. And the argument here, which I don't quite buy, is that if Hillary wins the election, she'll have a small window to expand health care access before the partisan gridlock kicks in. Well, I don't think the gridlock will ever ease. And I think from day one, if Hillary goes to Congress and says, I have a mandate from the American people to improve Obamacare, they're going to tell her to go do something to herself. But that's the argument that's coming here. And I do agree that this is a moment where there is an opening. But I don't believe that the bought and paid for Congress, dominated by Republicans, particularly in the House, will entertain this. And even if the Democrats get 52 seats in the Senate and they regain control of the agenda and the majority leadership, they won't have the 60 votes to pass a bill in the Senate. Now, they used a trick to pass Obamacare with less than 60 votes. But I don't think the Republicans and some conservadems like, West Virginia's wonderful Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, I don't think they'll go along with it. And so we seem to be stuck. And who's going to suffer? It's not going to be the health insurance companies. It's not going to be the health insurance providers. It's not going to be the pharmaceutical companies. It's going to be average Americans who don't get health care, don't get drugs, and lead a lower quality of life, or, as Alan Grayson put it, they just die. Well, more embarrassing disclosures from the John Podesta email hack. And this one is really interesting. If you remember about a week ago, I used some information that had been sent to me by a listener, and I later retracted it with an apology. And the listener, John LaFrancois, over in Sacramento, had changed one of the FBI documents to insert Barack Obama's name into a blank space where a name had been redacted. And it suggested that Obama had a private email account. Well, in today's New York Times, buried near the end of a story about the embarrassing leak that surfaced yesterday, an exchange between campaign staffers and John Podesta. And it started with Josh Schwerin. And there are two Schwerins on the campaign. Dan is a speechwriter, and his brother Josh is a campaign spokesperson. So Josh heard President Obama in a news conference talk about how he learned about Hillary Clinton's email system. He said he learned about it from the news just like everybody else. That's a little far-fetched. So Schwerin writes to Jennifer Palmieri, another communications consultant there on the campaign. Jen, you probably have more on this, but it looks like POTUS, President of the United States, just said he found out HRC was using her personal email when he saw it in the news. Now, Josh was careful not to characterize that as a damaging disclosure, but that's clearly the notion of this message. So then Cheryl Mills, who is the top assistant to Secretary Clinton, was there during the State Department years. Cheryl Mills writes to John Podesta only and says, "We need to clean this up. He has emails from her. They do not say state.gov." So again, they're being a little cryptic here because they can imagine that somebody like us will be reading this email later. And they were right to be guarded. So as the Times covers this, we get a clarification from Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary, suggesting that the president had no idea the emails could be a problem because he had relied on Mrs. Clinton to make sure that using a private account didn't break any laws. Mm-hmm. So as we dive deeper into this, what we learn at the very end of this article in the New York Times, the very last paragraph, this month, the FBI released a series of records from its investigation, which revealed that Mr. Obama had used a pseudonym to communicate by email, including with Mrs. Clinton and others. The FBI records did not reveal the pseudonym. So, John LaFrancois, this is vindication for the way that you modified that email just to show us what it would look like if Obama's name had been printed there. But you were not wrong to suspect, and now we can confirm that Obama did have a secret private email address. And as I speculated at the time last week, when Obama first took office, you know, he was complaining that they had to pry his BlackBerry out of his grip. And they came up with some sort of a system where he could communicate with certain people using email in ways that the spooks didn't think could be hacked or otherwise compromised. And I think that's what we are confirming in this account from the New York Times, based on the FBI, today. Secretary Clinton in the debates has called for a no-fly zone in Syria. And I have widely criticized this because we know it would require a major deployment of American troops. The Joint Chiefs of Staff has estimated 70,000 troops would be needed to maintain a no-fly zone. And because of Russia's entry into the fray a year ago, it is even less wise or more crazy to try to propose it. And I think you know that I have zero respect for Jimmy Clapper, who is the Director of National Intelligence, and I always like to point out he is a proven perjurer. Nevertheless, yesterday at the Council of Foreign Relations, Clapper said that such a move could lead to Russia shooting down American warplanes. Quote, "I wouldn't put it past them to shoot down an American aircraft if they felt that was threatening to their forces on the ground." And Russia recently deployed mobile S-400 and S-300 missile batteries to western Syria, which are capable of shooting down aircraft and cruise missiles. And cruise missiles are often referred to as standoff weapons, meaning that you can launch them from a ship or from the air, and so you don't have to have facilities on the ground to achieve that. So as we hear Clinton continue to call for a no-fly zone, and in the debate last week, Chris Wallace followed up with her, and she didn't answer the question on whether she would fire on Russian aircraft if they were violating the no-fly zone. But she only said that it would take a lot of negotiation to set it up, and she thinks she could strike a deal where Russian planes would avoid our no-fly zones. But the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joseph Dunford, told a Senate committee last month that for the U.S. to control all of the airspace in Syria, it would require us to go to war against Syria and Russia. And President Obama a year ago dismissed the calls for a no-fly zone, calling the idea half-baked. And as we approach the election, 13 days remaining, as I said, last weekend a federal judge blocked Florida Governor Rick Scott's effort to throw out tens of thousands of mail-in ballots and publicly reprimanded him. U.S. District Judge Mark Walker issued a blistering caution to Scott's top election official on a lawsuit about vote-by-mail ballots. And the issue is a little bit in the weeds bureaucratically. It has to do with whether people who do a mail-in ballot add their signatures to the envelope. And this is supposed to be a check on voter fraud. And while voting by mail is convenient, it is quite subject to manipulation. Because you could vote your husband or wife's ballot, your kid's ballot, any ballot that comes into your house, you're not really sure. So this signature is really the only security measure there is. And in Florida, if you don't sign it and leave it blank, they send it back to you for signature. But if there is a signature that doesn't match the signature on file for that voter, then the ballot is thrown away and it is not counted. So in Tallahassee, the judge said that he had a hearing scheduled for this past Monday, and he is concerned that authorities there are defying him. Quote, "This court will not allow the Florida Secretary of State to take a knee and deprive Florida citizens of their most precious right." And the judge said if one were skeptical, it would appear that the Secretary of State requested as much time he felt he possibly could to justify so that he could use every second available to run out the clock. And by wasting a week on his scintillating response, he quite nearly succeeded, the judge wrote. So there are a lot of efforts to mess with voting this year, and we're just seeing a few of them that surface. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast, and they do it by taking out subscriptions. Janet Price is an annual subscriber who just renewed. Grant Gibson in Portland kicks in $5 a month. And there's Terry Paris in beautiful Berkeley, California, who is a $10 a month supporter. I want to thank each and every one of you, and let's mention Faith People. She's right next on the list here. She's got multiple subscriptions and is a longtime loyal supporter. I'd like you to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page. It's real easy. You can pick $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever you're comfortable with. The $50 annual is available to you. And we've got bonus books on display on the sign-up page for people who take out a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address here in the continental U.S. Thanks for listening, and I do appreciate your support. I'm working this week on a special retrospective about Tom Hayden, an American revolutionary who helped lead the opposition to the Vietnam War. Yes, he was married to Jane Fonda for a while. Then he became a legislator here in California, serving for 17 years, and I got to know him well when he ran for governor in 1994. And I've gone back through my archives, and I even got an old radio broadcast from my syndicated show in 2008. I pulled up the archive for that. And I'm putting together a kind of tribute to Tom Hayden. And yesterday I was listening to our most recent interview from last summer in a book that it was prompted by a book that he wrote called Listen Yankee. And much of the book related to Cuba and Tom Hayden's relationship with the Cuban revolutionary Ricardo Alarcón. And I bring this up because I'm looking forward to releasing that podcast as soon as I finish it in the next few days. But we're seeing more movement toward the reopening of Cuba. And it happened today at the United Nations General Assembly, when the United States abstained for the very first time in over 50 years. The abstention was a resolution condemning America's trade embargo against Cuba. And we've always voted against that. And this year we went neutral. Now, it would have been ridiculous for us to vote in favor of it because it's a condemnation of American policy. But it does increase pressure on the Republicans to get real about Cuba. And at some point, they will allow that embargo to be lifted. I don't know that it will come very soon, but I think it is inevitable. Well, curious developments here. I first reported to you on Monday that almost 10,000 soldiers in the California National Guard who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and received signing bonuses in order to take another tour there have been forced to cough up those bonuses, to refund them to the Pentagon. Well, there's been a howl of protest, and you've seen members of Congress of both parties who are posturing about how outraged they are by this and how they're going to fix it just as soon as they get into the lame duck session. Well, at the Pentagon, they've announced that they have suspended this effort to collect the money back from our soldiers, and I, of course, believe that they should first collect money back from KBR, Halliburton, Blackwater, Khaki, Dyncor, and all of those military contractors who sucked huge amounts of money out of the federal treasury, and many continue to do so. But no, we're going to pick it out of the pockets of our soldiers. And again, I'm looking at a report from the New York Times, and it's not in the final paragraph, but it does note in passing that in 2014, the National Guard asked Congress to pass a law forgiving some of this debt, but Congress balked at the cost. So this is a creation of the Republican leadership in Congress. They control the House. They could have allowed a bill to go forward to correct this problem. But either because they don't care or they're cheap, they use the excuse, oh, this will drive up the national debt. I mean, the amounts of money in terms of our federal budget are ridiculously low, but these are a big hit to members of the service. They have to pay back $20,000, in some cases $40,000. So this is once again a problem created by the Congress, by the Republican leadership. And they're up there pointing fingers and saying, this is outrageous. I can't believe this is happening to our troops. And they cost it. Yesterday, I reported to you on AT&T's Project Hemisphere, a for-profit operation that gathers our information from telephone traffic on landlines and cell phones and sells it to government law enforcement agencies. There's no warrant involved. There is no suspicion of a crime. It's just available. And today, the latest disclosure on the surveillance state in America comes from the Washington Post, showing that inside the Beltway, there has been a 500% increase in the use of electronic surveillance, getting information on telephone traffic. In Northern Virginia, for example, electronic surveillance requests increased 500% in the last 5 years, from 305 in 2011 to 1,800 or more this year. And in the last 5 years, only one of the 4,113 applications for electronic surveillance has been unsealed, and there's only one case that we know of where the courts rejected a request to capture this information. And so this is another stunning example of how surveillance has become the new normal. It remains secret. We're not allowed to see the details of what kind of crimes were investigated, whether people were actually brought to justice, and whether the government, including the FBI, used these authorities appropriately. And this is what Obama has done. George W. Bush got away with a lot. He developed these new threads of surveillance domestically that applies across the board. We're all suspects now. But Obama has cemented it in place. This is the permanent landscape going forward. And you can't expect a President Clinton or a President Trump to do a damn thing about it. This is really astounding. And most Americans just, ho-hum, I got nothing to hide, man. They're fighting terrorism. Got to keep me safe. And Jason Leopold, once again, is the driver of these disclosures because he has brought lawsuits to force courts, or at least to demand, that they release this kind of information. Out at Standing Rock in North Dakota, we're getting details from the confrontation last weekend and the excessive force used by law enforcement on the water protector protesters. And as a march was underway to support several protesters who had chained themselves to bulldozers and pipeline machinery, the marchers were attacked by police who used pepper spray, beat protesters with batons. Dozens of officers backed by military trucks, police vans, machine guns, and non-lethal weapons violently approached the group without warning. From a loudspeaker, they heard, "Don't move, everyone is under arrest." As protesters attempted to leave, the police began beating and detaining them. Several Native American women leading the march were targeted, dragged out of the crowd, and arrested. One man was body slammed to the ground. Another woman broke her ankle running from the cops. The military and police trucks followed the protesters as nearly 100 officers corralled them into a circle. A 17-year-old pregnant girl, a journalist, and a 78-year-old woman were among those arrested. A total of 140 were detained in half an hour. Then they were transported to Mandan, the jail, where we heard Colonel Ann Wright report in from recently when Amy Goodman had the charges of riot dismissed against her. Now, at the jail, the place was overwhelmed. People had to sit on the floor in a common area. Two men were thrown into solitary. A number of women faced humiliating strip searches, which included spreading their body parts and jumping up and down while coughing. Now, I just find that to be really extreme, totally uncalled for. It cannot be justified. The arrested were refused phone calls, received no food or water for 8 hours after being arrested, and a journalist who is freelancing for The Intercept, Jihan Hafiz, who has covered war zones around the world, I believe she is Brazilian, she reported that her camera was confiscated and they claim it is being held as evidence of a crime. So it's getting really ugly out there. We know that the pipeline company wants to try to complete the work within the next month or so. And so I think that there are going to be more of these confrontations in Standing Rock. Over in the war zone, the United States is telegraphing its intention to, I don't know exactly how we do this, but we are going to encourage and orchestrate the rebel groups that we support in Syria to help push out the Islamic State from their headquarters city of Raqqa. Ashton Carter, our defense secretary, meeting in Paris, vowed that Iraqi forces, Syrian Arab and Kurdish allies, and U.S. special operations troops and air power could take away the Iraq and Syrian capitals. That, of course, is Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. But if you want a more complete view, I have linked to a great package, a roundup, published at Shadowproof today. And it provides a great deal of information from a variety of sources on what is going on in the war zone in Syria. And so, for example, we have commentary that Ashton Carter has made a series of blunders in trying to mediate between Turkey's President Erdogan and the leader of Iraq, whose name is Abadi. And Carter went to Turkey, said he'd made an agreement with the Turkish government that the Turks could participate in the battle for Mosul. And we know when the Turks claim they want to fight alongside the U.S. allies, they really want to snuff out the Kurdish problem that they see as a threat to their country. I don't see it that way, and their effort to persecute the Kurds is their own problem, but they inject it into the agenda for the war against the Islamic State. It makes them a hugely unreliable ally, and because there are three different Kurdish groups, including one in Iraq, the U.S. and Iraq in particular have been quite wary. So Ashton Carter made a deal with the Turks. Then he went to Baghdad, where Prime Minister Abadi rejected Carter's proposal. And here's commentary from Kirk Sowell, who says, "I must say, what an ill-conceived idea it was for Carter to back Turkey in a role in Mosul. Carter failed since Abadi publicly rejected his request, and it was inevitable Carter would fail. He shouldn't have tried. It would destroy Abadi politically if he agreed, and it will hurt America's position in Iraq to even have raised the issue." So I think this is very important information. And, of course, it's very hard to find in the corporate media in the U.S. today because they're too busy running down the, Donald Trump's latest lunatic comment and, avoiding covering the real meat of the Hillary Clinton email disclosures. So there's other information in this dispatch as well, including the Russian warships that have been sent to Syria, including their only aircraft carrier, which is a real leaky bathtub. It has its own tugboat because it's unreliable in getting from A to B under its own steam. And there's other information here that I think you would find useful. So click on the link and check it out when you have the opportunity. Two items finally today from the Vatican. And I applaud this move. I think it's in part because of guilt that Pope Francis feels. The Vatican and Argentina's bishops have finished cataloging the archives from Argentina's dirty war and will soon make them available to victims who have long accused the Church of complicity with the military dictatorship. Now, no date has been set for the opening, but they say the archives are all organized and digitized now, and they're going to make them available to victims, detainees, and the religious superiors of victims who were priests or nuns. But you'll recall that Pope Francis, who was the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, yes, thank you, and he also was a Jesuit priest before he became the bishop there, he's been criticized for not speaking out publicly at the time about the atrocities. And so maybe this is his effort to correct a bit of a problem in his own background. And this one I really don't know how to take, but just in time for Halloween, the Vatican has clarified its rules on the disposal of the remains of Catholics who've been cremated. They say you shouldn't scatter the ashes in the air, on land, or at sea, and that you shouldn't put them on the mantle at your house. The ashes of loved one have no place in the home. Now, I don't really follow why the Vatican is so concerned about this. One cardinal named Mueller said, well, we believe in the resurrection of the body, so burial is the normal form for the Christian faithful, especially Catholics. And you know, since the Catholics have been burying people for centuries, we kind of have a track record as to how many of those bodies remain in any condition to be resurrected. And even if the final call, Judgment Day, were tomorrow, only people who've been buried maybe in the last couple of years would have any remains that could be resurrected. So I find this really superstitious and kind of silly. And if that offends you as a Catholic, I apologize. That's not my intention, but I just call him as I see him. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment podcast, now available on YouTube. Subscribe over at YouTube and you'll get notifications of each day's release.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.